The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Manchester sides in not all conquering shock as City see Naples and tie, while United go to gigs to get draw, like an episode of Skins. We ran up all the midweek highlights, from that pearl from Perisic to Barca Milan to Inter's latest collapse. There's posts, tweets, the view from Spain, and a full and frank look through the weekend's action. Man United, Chelsea, Liverpool, Spurs, where to stage your pre-game protest before Blackburn, Arsenal, and news from Barnet. All of that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Well then, off we go. Today, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, James.
Hi, Barry. Paola Bandini.
Hi, James.
And Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Just back from viral and possibly bacteriological misery.
Oh, all sorts, yeah. Just our
fungus
old house
in the bedroom.
Had, yeah, damp and mould and all sorts. I think my sinuses have been playing up.
That's bad news, eh, listeners? Bad news for Sean. But good that you're here anyway. What an exciting midweek, eh?
It was thrilling. I mean, we have in past years been quite down on the sort of first group stage of the Champions League. But I thought it was thrilling. The games I watched, I saw, I think, four of them.
Which four games?
I recorded a couple. And I think the other interesting thing was that out of only two of the 11 English, Spanish and Italian clubs won this midweek. Now, admittedly, City played Napoli and Barca played Milan. But the fact that there were surprises, there were great games, it was good, right, to see.
Mm. There weren't a huge amount of goals, but there was plenty of excitement. I particularly enjoyed Man City-Napoli. Did you see that, Paolo?
Yeah, it was a brilliant game last night. It was actually quite heartening, I think, for lots of people who've been following Serie A and pushing the cause of Serie A, to see Napoli come and play their honest game and play as well as they're capable of playing. It's quite interesting. I'm actually just this second been perusing the statistics, and actually if you look at the possession numbers, you could get this idea of a game that was like Barcelona Milan, because City had 61% of the ball against only 39% for Napoli. But that is Napoli's game. Napoli love to hit you on the counter attack. They're such a fast team. They've got such dynamism going forwards. And I actually thought, there could have been more goals in the game, certainly, and City hit the post hit the bar a couple of times, but
Napoli
at the same time, Napoli
well.
Also hit the bar, and Napoli had one cleared off the line. So I actually think they had a game plan and they executed it very, very well.
No, I was just saying to Sean, but it was ages since I remember seeing an Italian team not getting a result in Europe, but getting a result it wasn't a huge result, but the fact that even when City equalised, Napoli went straight down the other end to look for another go-ahead goal.
Exactly. It reminded both of us, I think, of the great Juventus side under Lippi.
Or me, I think. But yeah.
But no, I was the one that threw up the United game in 1999, where Juventus went to Old Trafford and dominated in that first semi-final. It's nice to see Italian teams actually going for it, and it gives them a bit of...
See that every week if you want.
Well, a bit of hope with Milan drawing with Barca, as we'll come on to later.
Right. Can I just say, I know Sean is not generally like this, of that mindset at all, but I did find it intensely frustrating watching that game last night, that we're still in 2011 having these conversations, well, commentators on TV are having these conversations about how, oh, that was a defensive mistake. You don't expect to see that of an Italian side.
No.
I mean, 36 or 35 goals in Serie A this weekend, it's not... We're not still living in the early 90s.
But wasn't last season one of the lowest scoring record in Serie A?
Had to go and bring
years.
That up.
Last season was, but that only highlights the point that actually, if you compare all the previous seasons before that, the numbers are very much almost on exact par with the Premier League in terms of goals scored.
Does this take Man City down a peg or two?
I don't think so.
No.
I spent much of the match captivated by the sheer beauty of the Napoli team.
Yeah.
Physical. Edison Cavani.
Edison Cavani,
is
that's
a very,
your...
very handsome man.
Right.
He's got like sculpted cheekbones.
He has.
That swarthy complexion, lank, dark shoulder length hair, athletic physique. I would nearly turn for him.
Really? He's a kind of finer featured version of Amir Zaki, wouldn't you say? Is there not a similarity there in the kind of the brutish handsomeness of him?
Didn't notice.
He's a bit more delicate, the Cavani. And a terrific player, of course.
Yeah.
He's also an evangelical Christian, Baz, so I don't fancy your chances.
All right.
Barry knows all about those priests in Ireland, so...
what do I...
Barry, your point.
Well, my point was, I don't think it takes Manchester City down a peg or two. One thing that sort of annoyed me during the game, and I'm always sticking up for him when he gets grief that I think he doesn't deserve, is Ray Wilkins was the match analyst last night. And he spent large tracks of the game complaining that the behind the goal officials weren't doing anything, and why were they there if they weren't doing anything. I think Ray doesn't realise that they don't have to semaphore their decisions or input or, you know, do dances or anything. They just speak into the referee's ear and advise him, so they could just be standing
via
there mumbling
radio.
Away. Yeah.
Well, Cavani, of course, scoring as well, thanks to Gareth Barry's delicious assist.
Yeah, it was a howler from Barry, and these things happen. I mean, City got away with another one later in the game, but it's just lapses in concentration. I'm sure Mancini will give them a good talking to about it, but these things happen.
Another thing that Ray Wilkins was talking about was Tevez and his body language as that exciting moment when he could come on the field approached. He could barely contain himself.
Wilkins was making the point that he didn't look very enthusiastic in his warm-up, which was true. And then Tevez came onto the field and gave away possession, I think, first four times he got the ball, which would suggest that Wilkins had a point. I'm not a sportsman, I don't play, so I don't know about these things. But yeah, you would assume if you're going into a cauldron like that, you need to be properly warmed up. And Tevez was just sort of standing there looking around, doing sort of the bare minimum of stretches.
A lot of love for Walter Mazzarri, the Napoli a manager. Danny Gascon says, will you and the crew address the members only jacket Napoli's manager wore during the Champions League tie? Ridiculous, he says. Ridiculous, really.
I thought it was sensational.
Sensational.
Yeah. It was. I'm no fashionista. I'm not very good at describing these things, but it was sort of a purple, shiny number.
It certainly was. Not quite as purple and shiny as the one that Prandelli used to wear, Fiorentina manager, but an interesting choice for the sideline. Mazzarri, I think, had a fantastic game as Napoli manager. It was interesting to remember that he's the man who Napoli basically were all set to fire last summer, and thank goodness for them they didn't.
Yeah, well, it pretty much at one point it was sort of being reported that he had lost his job, and then there was a reconciliation. It was all to do with his ambition and the sort of expectations he had of what sort of players the club should be bringing in. And actually, you know, the club didn't have a sort of massive spend this summer, but the one player, the big player they did bring in, Gökhan Inler, was fantastic last night. I think he's a really important player for them. I think he breaks up play between the lines in a way that's not always the most obvious to see, but I think he did a really good job.
All right. I thought Gargano was good as well.
He was also excellent,
But not as good looking as Edinson Cavani.
No.
Don't you think Lavezzi would be more your style? A little bit racy.
What do you mean, my style?
Yeah, I can see Barry and Ezequiel Lavezzi.
It's actually the one unfortunate mark on the whole evening for Napoli is that Lavezzi obviously went off injured. And they're playing Napoli this weekend. Now, this was the whole source, as has been discussed on here before.
They're playing Milan this weekend.
Yeah, so they're playing... What did I say?
Napoli.
Oh, they're playing Milan, sorry. Yes, they're playing Milan this weekend. That was the whole source of Aurelio De Laurentiis, the owner's famous storming out of the fixture unveiling earlier in the summer.
Of course, Milan had to play. Sorry, Ben.
Well, I was just going to say Manchester City, there are six group matches. They have an away game after each of them.
Yeah,
and Manchester United have six group matches and they have a home game after each of them.
Coincidence at work again. City, their tough away game this weekend is at Fulham. Fulham haven't won in four games at the Cottage. Zamora came back in the last one. And Brian Rees, are we going to see him in this game, do you think?
Not if he plays or trains this week as he played in the first 45 minutes of last week. He was very, very poor against Blackburn. But he was playing on the flank, which I didn't necessarily think suited him. But it's still early days, but he didn't make a very good start.
He can't play in Europe. They're in the, Intertoto Europa League, that's it.
Fulham have played six matches at home so far this season because they had to go into the Europa League at the earliest stages, and they've only conceded one goal, so that's good defending and should test the mettle of City's attackers.
Right, what were you envisaging here, City?
Maybe they'll only win 2-0.
Oh, okay, all right. Milan-Napoli coming up at the weekend. Of course, we'll talk more about Milan later on, but to the other Manchester side... Manchester United also halted in their free scoring tracks, this time by the fifth best side in Portugal, Benfica. Lots of interesting talking points here and some uninteresting ones as well. Like, why did Sir Alex Ferguson make eight changes? Didn't he take this game seriously? And was Lindegaard playing a sign that De Gea, it's all up for him, etc.? They conceded a goal away for the first time in years. Yeah, amazing. And they only had four shots against Benfica. That's the joint first in the Champions League match in the last six seasons.
I really enjoyed the game. I thought Benfica started very brightly. They deserved to go ahead. Johnny Evans was, I think, at fault for the goal. But then when United equalised, they then, I think, deserved their point, and it seemed a fair result. And once Benfica lost Aimar, they lost that kind of will-o'-the-wisp character that could kind of, you know, go in between the lines and actually create something, and they looked a little bit more orthodox after that. But it was a good game, and because United are in such an easy group, they know now that if they win their remaining games, they'll win the group, obviously.
Benfica had a chance at the end with Marito, didn't they? But the thing that I thought was, on that Evans thing, I just thought it was interesting. Some people do seem to be saying that he was at fault. I think it's a really tricky one with a fantastic ball that's come across the field. If you're the defender, you've sort of got two choices, which is Evans didn't give him a lot of room. He was pretty close to him. You know, if you go much closer to him than that, then you're at a serious risk of just bundling him over, and you're going to give away a penalty, I think. So I think, or maybe it's just outside the area, but free kick, and very possibly get, you know, a yellow red card. Or you give him that tiny gap, and he didn't give him much of a gap. I think you've got to give Cardozo credit, because it was an incredible piece of control to bring it down and put it in like that.
Brilliant goal. Nesta would have stopped it.
Ferguson got quite tetchy after the game when Kelly Keith, Nii Dalglish, quizzed him about Lindegaard's performance and asked, you know, if this meant there'd be more competition for places in their coming game at the weekend, which I could kind of see his point in that he was giving out about being asked silly questions, but because managers...
Wasn't that silly?
Well, no, managers do get asked a lot of silly questions after games by reporters, but that wasn't one. And I thought it was a bit mean, but I suppose, you know, he's entitled to voice his exasperation. We should just be grateful that he's even granting us an audience.
Do you think it's a sign that he is actually already feeling stressed and under pressure by the fact that he feels that maybe he should go with Lindegaard this weekend in the big game at Chelsea, which perhaps we should come on to now?
Well, I think De Gea has been fine since he started.
De Gea is probably a little bit Freudian there, actually, Barry, given earlier. It's De Gea, of course.
All right, yeah. Sorry. Should I just come out and be damned?
Yeah. Don't think you need to at this point. Right. The Chelsea game. Yeah, well, they're the only team in the Premier League to have won more than lost against Man United, historically. Although recently their record has been slipping a bit. United have had the last two results over them. I think I'm right in saying they also had a European fixture during the week. They beat Bayer Leverkusen. Oh, you probably saw that. David Luiz, another strike from him. He's got more goals than Torres. Blah, blah, blah. Torres, blah, blah, blah. Off to Milan, blah, blah, blah. Will he play, etc.? Silly questions, basically, Sean.
They are, but I think Torres is interesting because he didn't play too badly on Tuesday night. And it's also interesting that Chelsea have been looking at his performances for Liverpool and his performances for Spain, his best performances, and trying to work out whether positionally he did anything different or whether, you know, his Opta stats are different, and they're not. And I think so they've basically concluded it's come down to confidence. And I think you can see that in his plays. I mean, often, instead of taking touch, bam, it's touch, touch, and then tackle, or, you know, he gets a shot off too late. So it's very interesting, I think, to see how Torres, if he plays, approaches it, but also how Mata plays, and also how Villas-Boas approaches his first big game against Ferguson. You know, will he go for it? Will he play those sort of pacey players out wide, or will he just try and keep it nice and tight?
I know it's going to be a great touchline duel, that, isn't it? Because Andre Villas-Boas, he can do spiky too, can't he? He can also do sachet and pirouette and all that other stuff. He's fantastic. You know, if you're for turning, Barry, I'm saying Andre Villas-Boas.
He's anyway, too young for me, I think.
Can Chelsea interrupt the Man United march in the Premier League?
Possibly. I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, that United have played a Spurs side that had no midfield, an Arsenal side that was practically a Carling Cup team. And so Chelsea will really come in, you know, and give them a proper test. United are clearly favourites. You'd assume they'd win, but I think Chelsea will push them hard. I think Anderson's quite interesting, though. I mean, he was flagged up by David Pleat on Monday as being kind of a player that's people have sort of gone under the radar, but has had a really great start to the season. And he's missed the last two pre-seasons because I think he did his cruciate and he also had knee problems the year before. And there was an interview with him in The Independent back in, I think, April, where he said, you know, he was asked, could he become one of the world's great players? And he said, definitely, I have the qualities for that. I know I can do it. And I think it's too early to say whether he could become that, but certainly he's become the key part of United's midfield.
How old is he?
23 or 24.
Mm-hmm.
Still young.
Mm,
he made his first team debut, didn't he, when he was 15, I think, for Gremio, because he lost his dad when he was 14. And he was asked once, what did his dad do for a living? And he just sort of moved his hands up to his mouth in that drinking gesture. Wow. So he had to provide for his family. So he's had it quite hard.
Man United, did you know, no side has ever won the Premier League after scoring more than 11 goals in their opening four matches. Nine teams have done it. None of them ever won the title. Now that's analysis. Anything else to add about Man United Chelsea? It should be a big game, this.
Yeah, I think it's. I think it's in some ways been healthy that we've had this Champions League round and both Man United and City failed to win. It's just sort of maybe calmed the hype a little bit. Which, you know, even I was sort of thinking after the weekend, crikey, we're just going to see this all season. We're just going to see City and United winning every game by 4 goals, 5 at a time, and perhaps, you know, teams that. You know, there have been good teams that have taken points off them in the Champions League, but at least it's shown that they're not unstoppable forces.
Yeah, none of you fancy a cheeky fiver on Chelsea?
I have to probably check the odds. I think United are odds on at 5-6, but I'd bet more than the fiver if I was going to back Chelsea.
Right, okay, sorry, Sean. I'm a bit of a small timer for you, I know. Have you and Barry had your traditional annual booking of the £20 for passage later on?
No, we haven't.
All right. What, is there nothing that you two disagree violently about?
No.
That you're willing to stake money
on? Not yet.
It's all free love.
I could just give him £20 now and avoid the hassle of and the stress of right having then. A bet.
We'll be talking more about Arsenal, their Champions League game. A valuable point, perhaps, for Borussia Dortmund later on, because right now it's time for a musical interlude. Now, elsewhere in the Champions League, Gasp takes a Turkish bath. Gasperini, that is, the Inter manager, as he takes the Nerazzurri to their worst start in 90 years. He's had 3 official games. He's lost all 3 of them. And I think it's fair to say, Paolo Bandini, that each time they've looked worse than on the previous occasion. The latest being this 1-0 loss at home to Trabzonspor. Not only are they the first Turkish team to ever win in Italy, but they're also a team that's only in the Champions League because Fenerbahce got kicked out because of that, you know, unpleasantness. The big question now is when will Gasperini, not if, get the bullet?
Well, the talk in the press this morning is that if he doesn't win against Roma this weekend, now that's a whole other story. They're having a terrible start of their own. But if he doesn't win against them this weekend, that it could be the bullet already. And there was a Massimo Moratti, of course, was asked about this. And I kind of enjoy this quote because it was such an unemphatic support for the manager. Will the Roma game be decisive? To say this would be to make it impossible for the manager and team to focus on their work. So he's not saying no, is he? He's just saying, I won't say that because it might make it quite tough for the build-up to the game. I mean, it's spectacular. And I actually, you know, I feel really bad for him. I also am aware that I've spent a fair bit of the pre-season defending him and saying, you know, this guy's not a mug. Mourinho thinks very highly of him and said he was the toughest manager he coached against. He's, you know, done well at Genoa most of the time he was there. But it's just it's as if it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy that everyone sort of said from the beginning, he's too tactically naive, this 3-4-3, it's not going to fly. And of course, last night he changed his to a four-man back line, still didn't work. Mm. And it's just the whole situation at Inter at the moment. You know, there are good players there still. There's still, this is why I was saying people shouldn't be so pessimistic. They've still got the core of that team that won the treble. I know Eto's gone, but you've still got Wesley Schneider. You've still got an attacking line that's, maybe not the envy of Italy, but certainly one of the strongest in Italy. Yeah. When you look at Milito and Pazzini and Forlan as well, although obviously he can't play in Europe. So I don't know. It's just there's just something I think really much less obvious than that's wrong with the club at the moment. It's much less obvious than tactics. It's just he hasn't got a handle on things.
Yeah. Well, to sum up the Italian reaction, the last couple of days have been all about where Gasp's getting it wrong, and they basically say that they're slow. And they don't look like they're bothered, which has been the complaint about Inter ever since Mourinho left. And it's just that Eto used to cover a lot of cracks just
the old players have certainly, I think, years of finally catching up with one or two of them. I think Zanetti and Cambiasso are players who've been leaned on very heavily in the last 2 years, and maybe Maicon as well. And they're players who suddenly aren't playing as well as they were.
On the subject of the Roma game this weekend, Cristiano Conci tweeting, he says, can the Inter-Roma match go to a negative scoreline? It's entirely possible the way those two clubs have started. Interestingly, were Gasperini to vacate the Inter position, names being mentioned include Claudio Ranieri, Delio Rossi, the man who beat Roma famously in a derby and then went for a midnight swim in a fountain in Rome in December, that man there, and this just in, Carlo Ancelotti. Carlo Ancelotti, who's on the front page of the Corriere dello Sport today, looking incredibly slim. He has lost a lot of weight, Carlo Ancelotti. He's now working as a pundit for Sky. And in that capacity, on Tuesday night, he made the call of the season When Milan were preparing to take that corner in the 92nd minute against Barcelona, he said, 2-2, Milan can equalise here, Thiago Silva, bosh. Amazing.
Well, that'll do nothing to improve the Italian reputation.
Yeah. Indeed. Now, quick word then on that Milan game. Incredible 2-2 draw at Barcelona. It really was extraordinary. Gazzetta's comment, you can't stop Barcelona, but you can put them in brackets. Milan scoring in the first minute, Barcelona playing the rest of the game complete dominance until the last minute when Milan equalise. And, well, to get the Spanish reaction to all of that, let's dial up Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, are you there?
Hello, James.
Hi, Sid. Are you in Madrid?
I am. I'm in the posh part of Madrid where in a minute you'll probably hear lots of beeping.
Beeping of expensive car horns?
Yeah, they are quite expensive, although obviously there's lots of van trucks.
All right, okay. Right, they don't stretch to mobile phone reception there, clearly. May I ask, what are you doing in the posh part of Madrid?
I had to come in to meet someone this morning, and I haven't quite got back out again yet.
All right, okay. Best of luck with that. Listen, what's been the reaction there in Spain, Sid, to, first of all, Tuesday night smash and grab by Milan at the Camp Nou?
Oh, crisis in Catalonia, James, because Barcelona have done it twice in a row now, drawn 2-2. Both times they were games that they really should have had tied up, that they really should have won relatively comfortably, obviously winning 2-1 in one of them in the 92nd minute, winning 2-0 after only 12 minutes in the other. I think most people, you know, fairly with some justification, are saying, well, if anyone deserves the benefit of the doubt, it's Barcelona. In both games they created chances, and maybe this was a slight lack of concentration. But one or two people have pointed out that there were potentially significant issues. For example, the fact that Barcelona started with Busquets and Mascherano as centre-backs against AC Milan, that Pato's pace was far too much than to the extent that they then had to force Eric Abidal to come across and effectively play as a centre-back, moving Busquets back into midfield. Then you've got the ultimate kick in the teeth, really, which is that the headed goal is scored by Thiago Silva, who's one of the centre-backs that Barcelona did look at in the summer but decided they didn't need.
Mm. Sid, I think I'm right in saying that there's very little that the Spanish find quite as distasteful as Italian football and the defensive mindset that they associate with it. And I was just wondering what the reaction had been then to Milan turning up in Spain, allowing Barcelona to completely run the game, apart from the first and last minute, and yet still emerging with a draw. Was there outrage?
Not really. I mean, there wasn't outrage, I think, largely because, of course, the main voices in the Spanish media are Madrid voices. I think if they'd done this to Real Madrid, there might have been slightly more outrage than them doing it to Barcelona. I also think there's becoming a sort of almost a begrudging respect. I read one of the match reports which says something like, let's face it, if they keep doing this, they must have something. You know, they must know, at the very least, how to keep themselves alive, how to keep themselves in games. And this ultimately, if it happens so often, which of course we all know it does, then perhaps it can't be entirely coincidental.
All right, well, moving on, Sid, Villarreal got whomped at home by Bayern Munich, but they're not big two, so that probably didn't get much coverage, did it?
That hasn't got a huge amount of coverage, but it has a bit. I mean, Villarreal are a side that most people in Spain really quite like because they've traditionally played pretty nice football. They're a side that you know like to maintain possession. They like to be fairly creative, although I actually think there's a bit of a myth built around that. When they reach the semi-final, on the basis of being very, very difficult to break down and maintaining possession as a defensive tactic as much as an offensive one. I think Villarreal, and I said this to you on Monday, I felt that they were vulnerable to Bayern Munich. Mm. There's something about Villarreal that just doesn't feel quite right at the moment. They're not getting some of the basic things right. They went for, I saw a remarkably kind of static and defensive field, a line of four and almost all of them central midfielders last night, and I must say I'm not entirely surprised by this. I still think they're a good side. I still think they've got a chance of coming out of the group, but of course for them it's a really, really bad start, not so much because of the defeat but because it's a defeat at home.
Yeah, indeed. Real Madrid meantime with a win in Zagreb, a game which saw Cristiano Ronaldo, poor chap, singled out by the crowd for all sorts of abuse. Why, Sid, why?
Well, Cristiano Ronaldo says that there's a very simple reason why, James, and this is something that I'm sure will resonate with you. He says people don't like him and they're jealous of him because he's handsome, rich and a very good footballer, which
right.
I'm sure happens to you as well, James. Everyone hates you for that very reason.
That's me, apart from the last bit and the one before.
I mean, I am really starting to warm to Cristiano Ronaldo. I quite, here comes the Blackadder joke follow-up, I quite admire his balls. I quite like the fact that he stands up and says, yeah, I'm brilliant, and what about it?
Yeah, fair enough. Excellent. Okay, I'll just finish off with a quick question from JB88, who says, How bizarre. This is something you touched on the other day, Sid. I have to say, it didn't make it past the final edit.
You mean you took out good things and now you're coming back to ask for them again?
Exactly, exactly.
I should refuse and say, no, I'm cutting from the cutting room floor and put that in.
Yeah, yeah. It, actually, it's fresh out. I don't know if it's possible. So how about you just answer A? JB88, he says, yes. how bizarre and I guess worrying to see four high-profile clubs, Sevilla, Villarreal, Atletico Madrid and Valencia, all without shirt sponsorship, Sid.
Well, and you know what I would say as well, more than just without shirt sponsorship, look at the Sevilla shirt and the Villarreal shirt. They look like pyjamas. And I don't mean to be snooty about sporting brands, but they're not made by famous brands. They don't look particularly good. I think that it's a reflection of something we've talked about before, which is that the economic situation of numerous Spanish clubs is very poor. But in particular, and this feeds into that whole argument about TV rights and so on and so forth, in particular it tells you something about the way that sponsors look at other clubs in Spain, and they look at other clubs in Spain as these aren't clubs that can really generate huge amounts of money for us. So if they ask, for example, I think it was something like 2.5 million euros that Sevilla got for their last shirt sponsorship, 2.5 million euros. Well, this is a team that's not in Europa League, not in the Champions League, doesn't generate that kind of money for us. It's just not worth it.
Sid, I can see why that ended up on the cutting room floor last time.
So we decided to do a short answer for you to actually use. Yes, it's true, they haven't got sponsors. It's a real problem.
Right.
But yeah. Sid, I mentioned a friend of mine from Ireland who's relocated to Granada recently, and I was asking him, did he go to the Andalusian derby in which Malaga spanked them on Sunday. But he said Granada have jacked their ticket prices up and that there are now 55 euros to go to a game. Is that ridiculously expensive by the standards?
No, the sad thing in a way is that it's not ridiculously expensive by Spanish standards. One of the things I think Spanish clubs get wrong consistently is ticket pricing, because you have relatively small clubs that don't fill stadiums that still jack up their prices. The other thing is that there isn't a kind of rigid structure. So whereas in England, I think I'm right in saying this, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most clubs will have category A, B and C games.
Sid, for example, I may be asking you about this again next week.
Cheeky bastard.
Sid, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for that. And enjoy your time getting out of the posh part of Madrid, and look forward to speaking to you after the weekend.
Next time I go on iTunes, when I finally get the thing fixed, James, I'll download Football Weekly, and I'll also download Football Weekly Uncut, the bits that didn't make it.
Tell you what, while you're there on iTunes, you can also download a European paper review, although I'm not supposed to say because we haven't launched this, but it's there, and in it you'll be able to see what Carlo Ancelotti looks like. Carlo Ancelotti, we should say now, actually, because he's super slim. That'll be in there. And probably there'll also be a bit of French reaction to Joe Cole's debut for Lille, which is...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If we see Carlo Ancelotti super slim, can we still be mesmerised by his absolutely fantastic eyebrows?
Well, for sure.
That seem to move around. Remember the spitting image puppet of Roger Moore?
Oh, yeah.
The eyebrows moved. It's like that. Carlo Ancelotti's brilliant to watch.
I love Carlo Ancelotti. But not in a Barry sense, clearly.
Sid, you should probably go. It sounds like the police have caught you.
Yeah. I think it is the pod police that come get me.
Thanks, Sid. I thought he'd never go. Sean.
Can I just say one more thing on Europe?
Yeah, please.
I discovered this week that my wife's best friend used to live in that the same house that Joey Tempest of the Swedish...
Final Countdown?
Yeah, the same house.
All right, then. And not just Final Countdown, but also Carrie.
No, just
yeah. Listeners know what I'm talking about. But we're heading for Venus, but still we stand tall because maybe they've seen us and welcome us all.
But he met his now wife.
Yes,
because she lost her wallet in Piccadilly Circus, and he helped her out, and they got talking, and eventually got married.
Wow, I bet he wrote a song about that because that is destiny writ large. Also, this week in Europe, lots of other things, but one of them was the fact that the Cypriots of Apple Nicosia got their first ever win in the Champions League, 2-1 over Zenit.
I was watching that game.
No.
Yes.
Tell us more, Sean.
Well, no, they played very well. I thought Zenit would dominate, but they gave Zenit the runaround, really, for a large part. Zenit got a goal against the run of play. At that point, you thought, well, you know, the Russians would cling on. They didn't, and Apple scored a couple of goals very quickly and deserved their win.
Hooray! Okay, that's it for part two. Very shortly, post and the Premier League weekend. Part three. Posts. Arsenal hack business. You recall they're suing this shop called L'Arsenale. Fisher, I wonder what Arsenal would make of the dozen or so professional football clubs that are also named Arsenal. It's a fair point, this. Lots of people making it, but they're absolutely right. Bacalieri says, Arsenal FC have made themselves look stupid. It would be like Chelsea suing Bill Clinton's daughter. Fair point, Barry.
Speaking of people making themselves look stupid, apparently that Victoria Beckham's legal folk getting onto Peterborough was an April Fool's joke.
No.
I'm crushed.
Right.
That only
was
one...
any humble pie left over from Monday or not?
I think there's usually a catering-sized tub of humble pie
in this
studio.
Okay, well, it's a bit of a relief, because what kind of world would we have been living in were that to have been
true? The thing, only one person has pointed that out, so, I mean, I'd like to think it's true, but it probably
I'd like
isn't.
To think it's false. Jimmy Stucklebricks wants to ask, you'll like this, about the state of the pitches in Italy and whether Juve's new stadium has a good pitch. He mentions a couple of clubs have gone synthetic. It's true, Cesena, Novara. Good pitch at the Juventus Arena.
Can we just cover this quickly on the synthetic pitches? They're not. These aren't plastic pitches. They are pitches that are natural grass, which has been woven into a base that is still mostly natural.
It's kind of a Rooney.
Basically. Right. But it's not AstroTurf. It's very much just a reinforced natural grass. But the pitch at Juventus already did look in a pretty bad state at the weekend, and that was, I think, probably partly the consequence of all the shenanigans that went on there ahead of the Notts County game. But there's lots of pitches in Italy that are in a terrible state. And actually, if these pitches at Novara and Cesena work as well as they appear to be doing, then I think you're going to see a lot of them in Italy very soon.
All right, then. This from One Iron for the Goal. I need to rant, and he then proceeds to at some length, about the Football League's handling of the Plymouth Argyle affair. It's tantamount to bringing the game into disrepute. The paralysis and lack of reliable communication is disgraceful, etc. and so on. Barry, you saw Plymouth this week at first hand in the company of James Dart.
Yeah, we went to Underhill to watch them take on Barnet. It was 90th against 92nd in the league. Plymouth are already adrift. They're in administration. I'm not sure exactly what the big kerfuffle is there, but their players haven't been paid in months. I think they were threatening to go on strike and eventually agreed to take 40% of their wages. I mean, these are guys who aren't earning huge amounts of money. They're not on silly footballer money. So, you know, there was some, I think the captain was saying, look, some of us are going to have to start selling our houses because we just can't go on like this. So I think they agreed a deal. They were going to get sort of less than half their wages, but some money anyway. Peter Reid's in charge of Plymouth. Larry Sanchez in charge of Barnet. Barnet won 2-0. Plymouth looked like they could have played till midnight and not scored.
Were there a lot of Plymouth fans there or not?
There was one little over 1,800 at the game altogether, and 430, I think, Plymouth fans.
Still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they're amazing. I suspect most of them were London-based. Like, for example, myself and James were having a pint before the game in the pub near Underhill, and we met this nice guy called Martin who recognised us and bought us a drink, which was very kind of him. And we watched the game with him, but he was one of many London-based Plymouth fans. 16 quid into the game, which I thought was a bit steep. But anyway, and that was to stand in the away end.
So that would have been a C-class ticket. I wonder how much their A-class.
17.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. We just thought we'd stand. We weren't being tight, like, to save a quid. We just wanted to stand. But I have to take my hat off to the Plymouth fans. They sang and chanted and cheered their team on throughout the whole game. Barnet fans were pretty quiet. And it was just like a routine expected win for them, I think. But that is a team in crisis, you know. And you hear fans of bigger clubs complaining about it, or journalists even writing about teams being in crisis because they're only fifth in the Premier League or they might get relegated to the Championship. But every game at the moment could be Plymouth's last.
Mm. It is a long, drawn-out agony, isn't it, for Plymouth? Lots of
James was also saying his dad's a season ticket holder and he's announced he's not going to bother going anymore because I think they've lost 7 on the bounce or something.
Mm.
It just must be so dispiriting supporting a team that in so much trouble and in such dire straits.
Mm. Now, Premier League this weekend, among the many talking points is Blackburn Arsenal. Arsenal, Paolo, haven't spoken about them yet. They got the 1-1 draw away to Borussia Dortmund, German champions. Disappointing because they were leading for so much of the game. But, you know, had you said beforehand they'll get a 1-1 draw at Borussia, I think a lot of people would have said, well done, Arsenal.
Yeah, it's the same situation as Napoli. You know, disappointment for the timing of the goal, but you've got to be pleased with the, with that result in a difficult group. But,
what an equaliser as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's an incredible goal. Ooh. I don't know if we necessarily learnt an awful lot new about Arsenal in this game. The defence still looked bad. Dortmund should have scored more than one goal probably at the beginning of the game. Certainly they had opportunities to. Going forward, they're always, you know, they've always got that potential. You know, Jovinho equally could have scored right at the beginning of the game. Robin van Persie took the goal, I thought, also exceptionally. You know, not as special as the equaliser, but still a very well taken goal on his wrong leg. Yeah, it was. You know, I just don't know if we necessarily learned anything new yet. I think everyone's looking for one game to fix everything or turn everything around. But actually, I think this was just similar to what we saw against Swansea.
But I think we have learned something new over these last 2, 3, 4 games. Is that Arsenal are very much more pragmatic now. They're not going to take teams apart and try and score the perfect goal. They realise their limitations. They realise that, you know, they've got Van Persie, and if it means they can keep things tight at the back and try and hit teams on the break with Van Persie, they can do things. I mean, people forget that back in 2006 when Arsenal reached Champions League final, they went 10 Champions League games without conceding a goal. And this was a team that had Flamini, I think, at left back, if memory serves. You know, so they can do it. And I sort of sense that Wenger's moved away from the model as he had to when you had Fabregas and Nasri, these creative geniuses, and he's having to be much more, you know, pragmatic in his approach.
All right, well, what's going to be the story then at Ewood Park? They're taking on Blackburn, who are bottom of the table and whose fans will be marching this weekend. They are marching in protest at the fact that Steve Keane is their manager. I think that's the big bone of contention. They did send a letter to Venkies about this last week, but now they're going to have a march. Barry, it's a popular and often effective tool of dissent, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they should shake it up a bit, though, and rather than go from the place that we're going to be to the place that we're going to anyway, you know, make more of an effort, like, say. I've been to Blackburn to interview, say, Carl Fogarty, the former Superbikes champion, and I think they could march from the train station to his house, which is, I'd say, a good 6 miles, and back, then to Ewood Park.
How about if they start at Ewood Park and then march somewhere else? Wouldn't that be the most effective form of protest?
Well, I think it would. And if they march to Carl Fogarty's house, he could make them tea or something.
All right, all options. Thanks for that.
Are you trying to make Carl Fogarty out some kind of Jesus? You're talking about 6,000 fans turning up, and he's going to magic them out like the bread and the fishes. And
he's got a big house.
Right, okay.
And he's got a big red Ducati in his front hall and a plinth.
All right, you've been to his house, Barry.
Yeah.
It's
lovely.
Good.
And he's got a picture or a giant poster of...
we get it, you've been to his house.
...the Nevermind the Bollocks album cover on his kitchen wall.
Next to the one of the lady tennis player.
Yeah. Yeah. And a picture of Elvis and Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Ah. Did you live in his house for a while?
No, that's a joke.
No, I'm an observant journalist. Right. I take things
in other Premier League news this weekend, Aston Villa take on Newcastle. Newcastle beat them 6-0 about a year ago, but that was at St James's Park, not Villa Park. Do you know that?
Sorry, if I could just interject.
Yeah.
I should probably add that even though I was in Carol Fogarty's house for an
he
hour,
wasn't there.
He didn't make me a cup of tea.
Oh,
fair. So he's unlikely to offer
the 6,000.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, anyway, but did you know, I'm going to have to rediscover that tone of surprise, did you know that Newcastle are fourth in the Premier League right now?
They are. And How did that
happen?
Well, I think they've had a kindish draw.
Yeah, but they drew 0-0 on Monday at QPR, and that rocketed them up to fourth. Has everyone else been...
I think they were lucky to draw that game. QPR should probably have won.
They're solid this season. I think Abaye has been a good signing, and with Cheick Tiote as well. They're a team that's difficult to break down. But you do look at them and think, well, if they'd spent some of this $35 million they got for Andy Carroll on a decent striker, they could... You know, they could be doing things this season. I think as it is, they'll probably finish safely in mid-table somewhere.
Oh, well, are they going to do something this weekend at Villa Park?
It's a hard one to call because I'm not completely convinced by Villa either. They've drawn 3 of their 4 games. They were very poor against Everton for most of the first sort of 60-odd minutes and somehow managed to scrape a 2-all draw. I saw Villa against Wolves and it didn't blow me away there either. It's a tough call. I mean, the obvious thing would be back a draw, but I don't know really which way that's going to go.
All right then, Sean. Newcastle, we mentioned their 0-0 on Monday with QPR. You saw that game.
Yeah.
Brilliant debut from Sean Wright-Phillips, is that right?
Yeah, he was marvellous. And Trapped was marvellous as well. Joey Barton did quite well.
Was it Trapped who forgot to kick off to start the second half?
I can't remember who. It was quite bizarre, actually. Yeah.
He was there at the centre of, what do you call it, in the centre circle, and then he kind of ran off as though he was expecting the pass, and then remembered, oh, actually, I didn't kick it to anyone, so then he ran back, kicked it, and then ran back to anticipate.
It was quite exciting. I was watching this game in my local and sort of remember turning to someone and going, have you ever seen that happen before in a football match? But I think QPR had, did they have six new players in making their debut in that game? And did very well, but both sides look very toothless up front. Oh. And you get the feeling that, like Sean says, with strikers, either of them could, you know.
QPR at Wolves, visiting Wolves this weekend. So that's a tough game for them, isn't it? Because Wolves in good form at the moment, despite their defeat to Spurs last weekend. Bolton are hosting Norwich, who haven't won in six in all competitions. Everton have Wigan. And Swansea will be looking for their first Premier League goal.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You look at the stats. Swansea have made the fourth most number of passes in the Premier League. They're only behind Chelsea, City and United. Now, I mean, it's not a perfect correlation, but generally, you know, the teams that pass more and have more possession do tend to finish at par up the table. And, of course, Swansea haven't scored yet, despite, you know, Danny Graham and the highlights I've seen seems to have got into the right position, hasn't put it away. Sinclair, I think, is dangerous. But there comes a point where plaudits have to be turned into points, and West Brom are probably not the team you want to play against, because they, you know, they're a strong team who are, you know, I think their position of 13th is probably false. They'll be higher than that coming into the season.
All right, interesting. This one's at home, of course, in that game. Sunderland play Stoke on Sunday. Yeah, also on Sunday, Spurs taking on Liverpool.
Glossing over Sunderland.
Well, we've given Sunderland quite a lot of attention of late. Okay, let me throw this to you. Were they to lose that game at home to Stoke on Sunday, could we see changes, do you think? I'm talking about Steve Bruce.
Possibly. I mean, Sunderland have played 11 games at home since January 1st, and they've lost 9, drawn 1. It's a pitiful record, you know. What is the exact opposite of a fortress, you know?
Straw house?
A straw, yeah, the one like the pig's head, yeah?
Yeah.
Right. There you go, Barry. That's your answer.
You could change the name to Bedouin Tent. Stadium of Straw.
Stadium of Straw. Sean, you were just nodding. When I mentioned Steve Bruce, sword of Damocles-style scenarios, you nodded.
Well, I think Quinn is very close to going. I think Bruce is perhaps wouldn't be that far behind.
So it would be Quinn first, then Bruce?
If I was a betting man, I think
which
Bruce,
you are. very much.
I think Quinn is close
to quitting or being
to going. Yeah,
very interesting. Well, big game then. The one there with the Potters on Sunday. Now, also on Sunday, this big Spurs Liverpool game.
Well, I can give you an interesting stat about Spurs Liverpool games. In their last 8 meetings, not one of those games has finished in a draw. Spurs have won 5, Liverpool have won 3.
It's normally goals as well. Last 3 or last 4 has been 2-1. I think Spurs won 4-1, didn't they, as well? So Spurs have a great home record against Liverpool in recent years, and there's normally goals. So.
Mm. Coming into last weekend, you thought Liverpool looked in better shape than Spurs, but Liverpool beaten, of course, at Stoke while Spurs got that impressive win at Wolves.
Well, I suppose it all depends if the referees are still out to get Kilkenny.
That's true. That's very true. Spurs, of course, in action Thursday night, tonight for us. In Europe, but leaving the likes of Luka Modric, Scott Parker, Gareth Bale and Emmanuel Adebayor at home. They're playing PAOK Salonika away. What do you think, Sean? Not about the PAOK Salonika, but about the
it's a hard one to call. I mean, I know Van der Vaart was saying on his personal website earlier this week that he thought he'd be fit for Liverpool. Now, clearly, if he is, that changes how you'd view the game. So I'd wait and see. But I'd hope there'd be goals, and I hope it'd be a really good game.
All right. Great start from Adebayor and Scott Parker at the weekend. Spurs, does it change where they're heading this time? Because I don't think anyone would have considered them realistic top four, top five prospects before those two pitched up. But a good start from them both.
I would have considered them part of that group. I think there's a group of a few teams who are going to be battling for one place, basically, which is probably Arsenal, Liverpool, Tottenham. I think those are the three, really. I don't know, maybe someone else will muscle their way into that, but I think that any of those, I don't think there's an awful lot to choose between those three teams at the moment, and you know, I may be proved wrong on that, but Arsenal, obviously, despite the signings they made at the end of the transfer window, probably took a little bit of a step back this summer. Tottenham managed to hold on to Modric. If they can get him playing as he was last season, he was playing fantastically, and if they can get the best out of Adebayor and Parker, then they're good additions. I think the issue with Adebayor, of course, is keeping his attention past the first five games that he plays.
Mm.
That list of players you mentioned that Harry has left at home, does this mean that he doesn't really have any interest in the Europa League? Well, and if so, is that not exactly the kind of tournament Spurs should go all out to win?
He called it a nuisance before it began, so I guess we can take from that he probably doesn't want to stay in it that long. But, a very fair point you make there, Barry. That's it, anyway, for today's Football Weekly. Oh, no, it's not.
Sorry, just one thing. The first Old Firm derby of the season is on this weekend.
Did we forget the first Old Firm derby?
Yeah, again.
How many will they have this year?
I don't know yet. It's hard to tell. They had seven last year, and we do mock Scottish football on this pod often with good reason.
Mock Scottish football?
Yes. Yeah. The Euro Disney League. But of the seven Old Firm derbies last season, I think at least five, if not six of them, were absolute belters of games, so they're always well worth watching. Unless it's the one that wasn't a belter.
Indeed. Anyway, well, there you go. Many delights ahead of us this weekend. Many thanks to Barry Glendinning, Sean Ingle and Paolo Bandini, and Sid Lowe on the line from Spain, guest producer Matt Hill, and we'll be back on Monday with Football Weekly. I say we, I won't. I'll be away, but I'll be back the week after.
Who's coming on here?
I'm not sure who's coming on here.
It's TV's Max Rushton, I believe.
There you go. There's your answer, Paolo.
Nice fella.
Super. He plays an instrument, is that right?
He plays the clarinet.
All right, then. Good. Listeners, I'll be back
and
the Monday after.
And he's been romantically linked with a Hollywood star, hasn't he?
Has he?
Yeah, some actress from Beverly Hills 90210. There was pictures in the Daily Mail of him.
A Hollywood star?
Well, okay. It's the new version of Hollywood.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Beverly Hills. But he was pictured in the Daily Mail. They were sitting in a park together.
This will be in on Monday, then. Crikey. Top celeb news and more in Monday's Football Weekly. Have a super time, listeners. Speak to you soon.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Now, I was going to mention Fernando Pique at this point, but I don't know if I'd be kind of biting off more than I could chew, if you know what I mean. It's, you know, those photos, you remember when he appeared...
Gerard Pique.
Who did I say? Fernando?
Fernando Pique.
Yeah, sorry. Gerard... yeah, interesting. Gerard Pique. Yeah. He was putting those jeans through a lot of work, if you know what I mean. There was... Yeah.